40 episodes of Dying to Ask, and even though the word dying is in the title, we've never really talked about death.
That's true.
Until today.
Until today.
So my friend Beta Ryan, she's a producer for NBC News, and she lives in Sacramento. She travels all over, and she listens to the podcast when she's on the road, which is super cool.
Nice.
So she sends me this email, and she says, you've got to have this guy at my school. He's like one of the kids' dads. You have got to have him on the podcast. He wrote a book. Right?
Yeah.
Sidebar, I'm the only one who hasn't written a book.
Well, you've certainly read a lot.
I have read a lot. So anyway, so Beta, she's a great judge of stories. I'm like, yeah, I'm all over it. So the guy's name is Chris Meyer, and his bio is all over the board. So try to diagram this with me. He went to law school, and he passed the bar. He was a screenwriter. He wrote and produced a feature-length, low-budget film that got a write-up in Variety, and he made it to the Rome Film Festival, so he was kind of on his way.
Yeah.
Bounced around Hollywood. He worked as a production assistant to the legendary photographer Herb Ritz. Then he had a kid. And let me tell you, friend, things change when you have a kid because you start to feel a different kind of pull. And he decided it was time for a radical change in his life and a little bit of security for his family. And he got into a business that is guaranteed to never lose customers, and that is?
Death.
Death. Funeral business. So he spent 14 years running a funeral home, and he's written a new book about the life he found after death, so to speak. It's called Life in 20 Lessons, What a Funeral Guy Discovered About Life from death. And it is good. Like, it is really funny. Death is funny. I don't know why, but it really is sometimes. And it's really profound. So on this Dying to Ask, how a guy with that kind of a bio got into the funeral business, which is a business. You're going to learn some really weird stuff today.
Yeah.
What he learned about failure the time he told Mel Gibson that his work was crap. And I'm only loosely paraphrasing what he said. And then how he's learned to be a more empathetic, present person by being around death a lot. Hmm. So this is the ultimate story of reinvention at its finest. Meet Chris Meyer. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. They write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. I was so excited when Beta sent me that email.
She's so great.
She's good. She's good people. She sent me this email and she's like, you've got to interview this guy that's in, he's a parent in my kid's class.
Yeah.
I'm like, we should probably tell
that story too because it's great because I'm like, hey, Beta, can you get me on the Today Show?
And she's like, is that
like,
what you said?
I totally did. And she's like, they passed, but I get you to Deirdre. And I'm like, thanks.
Wow.
So,
wow.
I know, right? So
huh. I don't really know how to take that.
We need to tell that story because it's so classic.
Well,
it's
let me tell you something.
Well, they didn't really. Today's show in New York doesn't want you, but I got you to do it.
But the Dying Ass podcast will take you. Hashtag so, they'll take
exactly.
anyone.
That's kind of what it was. It was like she passed, but you know, she wanted to be so positive for me. So I'm grateful. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? And here's the thing. I like her so much that I bit without even reading the rest of the email.
Oh,
thank
you.
I was like, I bit. Because she knows good stories.
Yes.
And your story is like,
yeah.
I told you before we started this, I'm there's no outline.
Yeah.
We're just going to see what happens
today
because it's such a
it's
crazy story.
Fun. I know.
It's
a crazy life.
It is a really, really crazy life.
Yeah.
How did a very nice guy like you, who clearly likes the Today Show better, get into the funeral business?
Yeah.
Like, how?
Okay.
Okay.
Are we gone?
Yeah.
Oh, we've been gone for a while.
Oh, sorry.
You think I'm cutting that
part out? Oh, my God. I didn't know we're ripping. You never said ripping it.
You know
okay,
what? Because I'm not cutting that part out.
Okay.
No. The confessional is underway.
The confessional is underway.
All right.
So my foray into the funeral industry came from, like we were talking about, my wife and I had our first son in Los Angeles, and I wasn't making it as a screenwriter. I had a manager and an agent, but it was not happening, and my wife was working, and she came to me one day, and she said, you know, I really want to be a mom. And I said, you know, I was heartbreaking, right, because it was my career for the last 10 years. And so I said, well, what am I going to do? My family was back east in New York, and I said, where do you want to be? And she's like, let's go near my family up in Lodi. And I was like, Lodi. And I've heard the Creedence song.
Yeah. Do you know Lodi's motto? Livable, lovable Lodi.
Okay. Well, it is lovable. I do love Lodi. I've come to love Lodi. And so she had a friend who was a mortician who at every family gathering had been saying, Chris, this is a steady thing if you ever need, if you ever want to get out of screenwriting and find something steady.
How do you even respond to something?
Yeah, I mean, over the exactly. Years? Like you two just responded probably. I mean, it was very much like, yeah, okay, yeah, kind of pushing off. And then when my wife said, I want to be near my family, I was like, oh my gosh, I better call him and see if he wants to do this with me. And he did. And we were very, very lucky to find a funeral home that was on having financial difficulties.
Said no one
Believe
ever.
It. Yeah, exactly. Said no one ever. And we purchased it with the help of my parents and turned it around. And yeah, that was it. It was sort of a by fire everything. And I knew how to be respectful to people and be kind to people. Mm-hmm. That's about it. And
yeah.
he was the mortician, and I had a little bit more business sense, but not really as 10 years as a screenwriter, you know. But we just turned it around, and I came to love it and the people. And, it was hugely, hugely frightening, though, because as you can imagine, both of you seeing dead people, being around dead people, the whole embalming room, picking up people at places of death. I mean, it was harrowing. Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Let's go real quick back into your background. Even before you were a screenwriter, you went to law school.
I did. Yes, I went to law school, and I went to Vermont Law School, and they had this program where you get your master's if you go straight through the summer. So I have a JD and a master's in environmental law and policy. And
you took the bar.
I took my bar in New York City.
And
yes, crazy enough, I passed it. Well, there's a story there, too. I failed the first time. And my mother's like, Chris, you studied for that thing so hard. You need to go up to Albany and check out. I think they made a mistake. And honest as God is my witness, I went up to Albany and they did. They marked an essay part a 1, and it was actually a 7.
Are you
and
serious?
Appealed it, and I won. So I don't know. I don't know that's ever happened before. We've heard stories of that, but
that's like a baller lawyer move, right?
Yeah.
There.
Well, it's my mother. I mean, I would like to say, you know, it's like my mother must be a baller because
or
I certainly wasn't.
You're a mama's boy.
Yeah, I'm totally a mama's boy. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Now she doesn't think so, but youngest of 3 boys, so totally.
That's
a mama's
crazy.
Boy. Yeah,
okay,
crazy story.
So you actually passed the bar. And then how much law did you actually practice?
Yeah, I practiced 0 law after that. Parents hugely proud of me. I can only imagine. I'm paying for law school and my master's degree. And then, as I mentioned, I got approval somehow at law school to write a screenplay about law school. And then I turned that into sort of a race relations drama about you know, the Watts riots were going on around that time. And so I made a short movie, independent movie in New York City for about $100,000. And what I did differently is the black actors played the white people and the white actors played the black people. And
huh.
It was sort of it was called Black is White. And we went to a bunch of film festivals. And my whole hope was to go to Sundance. You know, that's sort of the granddaddy of them all. And I didn't get in. And when I didn't get in, I was totally crestfallen because I had gotten written up by Variety magazine as the film to watch. And I was kind of like on the edge of my seat thinking, oh, my God, you know, I was at the Angelica Film Festival and I just got written up in Variety. So I was feeling pretty good. And then I didn't get into Sundance. And so I was like, oh, man. And so I said, Mom, Dad, I'm out. I put my film in my car and I drove to L.A. in two and a half days, something like that, crazy, just went straight there and just started a career as a screenwriter because that's what I loved. Yeah.
Wow.
Insane. Yeah.
Do your parents still talk to you?
Yeah. It's sporadic, Deirdre, but yes, they do.
So then you get into screenwriting and you spent like how long? The next decade?
Yeah,
in
I was
Hollywood?
There for 11 years in total. And, you know, I knew I didn't want to be a writer and I didn't want to be a lawyer. So I really I figured if I was going to be a writer, I needed to get better. And I needed to work, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day doing it. So that was the big thing for me. So I needed a job that could kind of be flexible with my mm-hmm. writing. And so I had a friend who was in the commercial production world, and he worked for a company called Ritz Hayden. And Ritz Hayden, the The Ritz part is Herb Ritz, and he was wow. sort of the greatest fashion photographer of his day, and he died of AIDS, you know, many years ago. But at the time, they were making commercials and shooting supermodels, and so.
And what was your job, Chris?
My job was model wrangler for a while there, and it was pretty great. I don't know how it actually happened. I tell this story all the time, and. You know, I remember picking up Helena Christensen at the Chateau Marmont and driving her to set, and Cindy Crawford was there. And no, it was a pretty great life for a while.
You've
there.
Lived yeah. a very charmed
yeah, it was
life.
It was totally charmed. Yes, I say so humbly.
Let me ask you: what did you learn about just life and business during that part of your life?
Yeah, so that's a great question because that you know a lot of people think Hollywood, right? How glamorous. And for me, it was brutal. It was a very tough life, an insane amount of rejection, people looking you in the face, just telling you you never make it.
Is this still the model wrangling?
No, this is a streamer. There was some of that too, dear. Just, you know, thank you for putting that up. But no,
you're
I mean,
really,
this is the really this is the writing part, dear. Not
really
the model.
Today's show, I yeah. said yes right about now. Boy, that Savannah Guthrie would have
so
been
good.
More professional.
Yes. God, this is brutal. Savannah, I'm still
Al
here
Roker
for you if you need
been
it.
Nice to meet
you. You look so trim these days. Anyway, so no, I'm talking about the screenwriting, and you know, it was great. I got a manager and an agent, and I was working my way up, and slowly but surely, you get fans in the industry within this sort of subculture of Hollywood. What people don't know about Hollywood is there's really I always say 15 people in Hollywood who can say yes to a movie. Everyone else, this whole subculture is just sucking up to those 15 people.
Interesting.
And I think it's probably even fewer, you know.
Well, Harvey Weinstein's out, so.
Yeah, Harvey's gone.
Maybe 14.
Yeah, exactly. But
that's really
it was
interesting,
fun.
Though. Because, like, when you deal, and I always wonder, like, for people who give it a try at a dream like that, how do you know when it is time? I mean, obviously you had a child, but like, how do you know when to give up on a dream? That to me is a really like huge thing in a field like that.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what your podcast was getting at. For me, you know, what struck me about your podcast is that when is it time to say no, right? And that, I don't usually hear that in my brain. I think some people do hear mm-hmm. that. Hollywood is very much a place where if you're sort of the prettiest or in your small town in Iowa and people are always telling you you need to be an actress or, you know, people flock to LA and you don't hear those stories of the people that go home, right?
Yeah.
You never hear those stories. You hear
or they
the
get
story,
into like insurance
yeah,
or something,
insurance
right?
or whatever. Yeah, exactly. Or whatever. They marry someone and it goes on from there. But yeah. So I think for me, your podcast struck a nerve because it's the ability not to hear no. You know, and I think that's what Hollywood did for me because I knew I was good. Like I inherently, maybe it was an inflated sense of ego, but I knew that what I was writing was good and that people were just telling me no, 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 no. And I just kept hammering. And I think that resiliency is something that I tried to get across in my book and, you know, hammer it in life. Just don't hear no.
Yeah.
Put your blinders on and just keep going.
What were you writing during that time?
So I was writing all kinds of things, but I ended up flocking to children's, you know, movies. So I wrote a movie called Frank the Frog that, you know, was very close to being purchased. And I've written that. That was my genre, sort of like a G, PG-13 for the mass market. Yeah.
And then you got into the funeral business.
Yes.
We're going to take a quick time out. Great. And when we come back, you make that decision after having your first son. You come on up to Northern California and find yourself in a world like you thought Hollywood was crazy with all those models. This is totally different.
Yes, very different.
And we'll get the details on that right after this.
Cool.
Jeff, you know how when you plant a garden, you water it so it will grow?
In theory, mm-hmm. yes. I've not done this myself.
Yeah, that's not how podcasts work, though. We need ratings and reviews, so please take a second when this episode finishes and leave us a quick review on Apple iTunes. I read all of them, and whoever ID'd themselves as L3SF and suggested that I slow down a little bit, you were right. So thanks for the feedback. Back to the show. When I was in college at the University of Missouri, I worked on this business show, and I got assigned to go spend 3 days at a funeral home. So I was dragging all my gear around. And back then, you know, you pretty much worked on your own. So it's me. I'm dragging like a big deck machine and my camera and my lights. I'm wearing my super cool suit from Casual Corner.
Sure.
And I spent 3 days there. And when I first got there, I was really, really creeped out.
Yeah.
All of it creeped me out. And by the third day, I felt oddly at home, and I found it absolutely fascinating. And for me, what it did is it kind of normalized death, because at that point in my life, I was like 20, 21, I hadn't really known people who died. Yeah. I hadn't been through that whole experience. But being behind the scenes at a funeral home was crazy.
Yeah.
So when you go from, you know, you've got a new baby, Hollywood, and you walk in there for the first time, and you have taken the loan and signed on, what was that like?
Yeah, it was terribly frightening. I mean, all of those things you just described, it was very similar for me, and maybe even worse because I thought I was more squeamish. And I was lucky that I had a friend who was a mortician, and, you know, he kept saying to me, Chris, you know, do you want to take the next step? Do you want to take the next step?
What was the next step?
Well, the next step was, do you want to go start picking up bodies? You know, do you want to start, you know, going into the coroner's office? Do you want to start going into some of these remote coroner's offices where things are a little less formal? Do you want to start, you know, going in the embalming room when an embalming is going on, you know? And for me, I always said yes. And the reason I said yes was because of my child, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had 10 years, 11 years being a screenwriter, and that was my time. And I felt that, you know, I was looking into that little boy's eyes, and those, like, you know, I describe in the book, those azure blue eyes looking up at me saying, hey, man, show me what's going on here. How do we do this? And I knew I didn't have plan B. So not having a plan B was really, really enlightening for me because I had no choice. And so I had to say yes to everything that the mortician was telling me. Hey, let's do this. Let's do this.
Isn't it interesting, too, that most of us until, like, your first time going to a funeral home is usually because you need the services.
Yeah.
So you're in an awful place, and it's kind of like planning a wedding, completely foreign.
It's a very similar to planning a wedding. 100%
right. Foreign. And mm-hmm. It's kind of the same guest list.
Yep.
You know, but really? It's... But it's really different. And so you put a lot of trust into someone and you make these huge decisions, not cheap decisions, usually pretty quickly. So what do we not know about that process? Like when you talk about going out to collect a body, I mean, like it's weird, but like it has to happen.
Yeah. So that whole process, I mean, I think the best thing is if you take anything in your life and you plan for it before it happens, it's better because you make smarter decisions, right? So I'm in this business called Magilla, and that's what we're all about for the borrowers. We're trying to plan what is going to be like when you buy that commercial property or real estate property. Funeral business, same thing. If you could plan ahead of time, 6 months, 2 years, 10 years of what's going to happen at that time, much better, better financial decisions, all those things. And that's something that people don't want to do, right? No one wants to plan for their funeral. Mm-hmm. So invariably, the funeral industry is one of those industries where you're making decisions in 24, 48 hours, and they're bad decisions, and they're fast decisions, and they're rash decisions, and you really want to be thinking about, you know, memorializing your loved one. You don't want to be thinking about business decisions.
Right.
So planning is important. In terms of what people don't know about death, I think you asked that. You know, the first thing is it's permanent.
True that.
It's definitely permanent. True that. It's permanent and it's messy and it's never a good situation, you know, no matter what. You know, we all think, man, I want to live to 99. I want to have a great meal the night before. I want all my loved ones, everyone who loves me around me, and I want to close my eyes and I don't want to.
How often does it work like that?
It never happens like that. Just literally, it never happens like that. And that's the most important thing to kind of get across to people and to try to let them behind the curtain. The end is horrible. It really is. And it is commensurate with the amount of love you feel for that person, how bad it is. That's kind of what I've noticed. I had a great experience to be around my grandfather, who was my best friend in life. I was just very lucky to be with him as he died. And it was horrible because, you know, he had the onset of Alzheimer's. And if you, you know, you add that into the equation and they're sort of not really knowing who you are, it's even more painful. I can't even imagine what it was for my mother, you know, yeah. as her dad. And so I almost wanted to, for her to stay away yeah. and let the grandson take care of some things. And not that I did, you know, I just did what a grandson would do kind of things. So I think that's the key thing that I would want to get across. It's really hard, it's messy, and it's not pretty.
So when you first started, you know, saying yes, when your partner, the mortician, is, do you want to take this on? Like, one of the things I didn't really think about was the fact that, you know, before a body ends up at a funeral home, someone's got to go pick it
right.
up. And
right.
so you would be kind of the guy showing up at the house.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, I have so many fascinating stories of that because, you know, as you can imagine, the range of emotions that you're walking into, whether it be an entire family. I think one of the stories in the book, I talk about this matriarch dying in this family and how they lined the hallways for us to go pick her up and how powerful that was for me because, you know, my whole preaching of the book is about love and family. Be with the ones you want. Just, you know, we don't have to have all these friends that we think we need to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that small set. And that was very powerful for me to take her from her home.
That must have been an unusual experience, though, you know, the first time you go to do it. I mean, it's not like they taught you this
right.
in law school.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's it. Because sometimes you get into a situation and the people are angry. You know, they're angry and you... I think the psychology of it all is really was one of the greatest takeaways because you need to walk into a situation and you need to suss out the personalities really quickly and find out who sort of the drivers are and who's angry, who's not, who's been drinking, who's not, who's dehydrated, yeah. who's not. You know, all those things come into play and it can be very difficult. And the people don't always die in great positions. You know, I've talked about in the book, I've taking people off toilets, in showers, in the backyard, face down. You know, it's crazy the way people die. And we don't think about that,
no.
right? We just think that everything's cheery and they're in the funeral home in a beautiful casket.
Well, like in a movie, you just right. close your eyes.
That,
it's very clean.
Exactly, and it's over.
Yeah.
The behind, you know, taking people into the funeral home, placing them in a cooler, you know, so the body remains, you know, doesn't decompose fast, if they're going to be embalmed, if they're not going to be embalmed, if they're going straight to a crematory, you know, all those things are things that we don't think about behind the scenes.
How long into owning the funeral home were you when you said, what the hell have I done?
Yeah, I mean, less than 24 hours. Yeah, I mean, it was that quick because you're right. I mean, it's one of those industries that you generally have a calling for and you go to school for. ARC here has
yeah.
a great program.
Or you grew up in it. I mean, aren't
or you grew
many
up in it. That's
funeral
it.
Homes generational?
Totally, totally generational, exactly. Either owned by large corporations, but mostly you're right.
Because you don't see like, oh, we got a brand new funeral home
right.
opening up. That is a pretty
right.
rare
thing.
Thing.
Yes, it
like
is.
Going out of business sales.
Going, exactly. you don't see that very often.
No.
Yeah. So, yes, and... I didn't have the calling, and like I said, it was out of necessity. So it was exciting, though, and like I said, I would do it all over again. It was the greatest time of my life because the most important thing that it taught me was perspective, right? And I think that, especially coming out of being a screenwriter, I was just like, I got to make money. I got to, you know, afford a family and, you know, the things that we all think about when we're mm-hmm. starting out. You know, we got to get going. I got money, you know, how do I get to pay for this, the house, this, that. And, you know, probably 2 years in, I'm like, whoa, you know, this is really deep, you know. And I think also probably about 2 years in, I thought to myself, I don't know if I can make this a career because I was sitting with families and I was getting too into their stories.
Oh, yeah,
and,
I would too.
Buying in and feeling emotional and going home and I could feel like, oh my God, I'm hurting. Like I could feel myself hurting on a daily basis. And I talk about a passage in the book that you could kind of go to one of two ways. You could start drinking at 10 a.m. in the morning or you could just go home and say like, oh, I'm home. I got my little guy here. Let's go play baseball and get out and do that. And I went the other way. I just went for my kids and just took those lessons that I was learning on a daily basis and just applied it to my family.
Sometimes I'll have some of my millennial colleagues here, and when they find out how long I've been working in local news, which has a shelf life for a variety of reasons, but the main one is burnout, because it is not an easy schedule and it's not an easy job, and burnout's pretty high. And I'm in unicorn territory at this point, especially with morning news, you know, really, you know, hung in. But they'll say, like, how can you keep doing it? And I always give them the same reason. I get paid.
Yeah.
I have a mortgage.
Right.
I have kids. I have responsibilities. And it's funny, like, you start to look at, it's great if you can have a job you love that also meets those other obligations. And you can't always... You can't always just follow your passions when other people are waiting for you at home. And it, your story really resonated with me because of that.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head for me, right? So a lot of us get caught in that, right? And we need to make money. We need to pay our mortgage. We need to put food on the table. And that is just a basic human instinct. But I always say in my head, think about your day. And there is always time in your day for ideas to germinate, right? So even your crazy schedule, right? You said you're getting up at 2 in the morning and you're here. If we look at a human being and we look about how much time we waste in our day and how much time we're watching TV or Real Housewives or, you know, whatever we're doing, there's always this time for an idea to germinate. And I think... although you have those basic human needs that you have to take care of, you need to be thinking about what your passion is or what is going on. How can I do what I really want to do? And there's time for it. There is time for it.
I think that's so true. And I think that the way you structured the book, and this is what sucked me into reading it, is that you tell those great stories about wrangling the models,
right.
Going to law school,
right.
Not actually practicing
right,
law.
Right.
But you tell some really great things from along your life, but then you sprinkle in these really, at times tragic, at times ridiculously funny stories of being in the funeral business that are all just really about life in general.
Yeah.
And how you choose to look at different times in your life.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to all have perspective. I think, you know, especially in today's society, we're just, you know it better than anyone. You see it every day, just the violence, the tragedy. I mean, you almost become desensitized to it. And what I'm trying to say is, let's all just, you know, go back to the, maybe not the old way of thinking, but just bring it back home, right? You know, I see more people farming. I see more people playing games at home. I see more dads at school picking up, you know. I talk about that in the book, the huge resonance of 911. Yesterday we had a nice memorial. That the resonance of that day in the collective consciousness in America, I think it changed then. And I think we all said, whoa. Everything is not taken for granted. You're not going to be given tomorrow. That is the whole thing of my book. You don't know. I have buried children. I have buried teenagers who thought they were going out with their friends on a motorcycle, just having fun, right? You don't know. So that's why I'm saying do what you want. And that's why this podcast is kind of so cool, right? I mean, it's just different. Do something different and don't hear no. So, huge, huge part of my life.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, I want you to tell us the story of Patty.
Yeah.
Who came to you under, I would say, pretty unusual circumstances. And she said, take care of me. And you did.
Yeah.
We'll tell that story right after this. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record. You might have to help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts. Opportunity now through this to be around a lot of people who, you know, you're constantly learning in a job like this. And you had a woman who walked in once that you write about in the book. Her name was Patty. So set it up. This family comes in.
Yeah, just a husband and wife, really. And they walk into the funeral home. And you know, you said it again. People are totally creeped out when they walk into a funeral home. And
100%.
It's not the warm, fuzzy feeling. And they were, you know, at a distance, and I could see they weren't ready to talk to me, and they were looking around, judging the cleanliness of the place. And
is that what people do?
That's what people do, for sure. The smell is probably one of the first things, right? And we traditionally try to have a nice warm fireplace, and they're looking around, and I said, you know, I'm here if you need me, and they said, okay. And they slowly walked down the hall, and you know, particularly her came into my view, and she came sort of out of the shadows into the light, and her whole entire face was slumped over on the right, and she had obviously looked like she had had a stroke to me. And, you know, she said, hey, we'd like to make some funeral arrangements. And I said, sure, you know, for your father, your mother, who are you making arrangements for? And she looked me right in the eye, and she said, for me. And that had never happened. That was probably about 4.5, 5 years in. And I had never made funeral arrangements for someone who was currently living. And so we sat down and she told me the story and, you know, how she had a tumor and the doctor had given her just a not much time to live. They didn't know for sure. And she said, my husband, who was with her, and standing right there, he said, you know, he's not capable of doing something like this. And he wasn't offended. You know, I was like, oh, whoa, snap. And I was like, you know, but he was not offended. He was just kept looking at the ground. You could tell that he was just so singularly focused, like, oh, my gosh, my wife is going to die.
Yeah.
And, you know, we sat down and, you know, she listened to my sort of not pitch, but sort of the regular spiel that you have when you're telling people what you're going to go through. And, you know, she was just literally locked on my eyes and she was, you know, I was trying to look at both of them to be respectful and include the husband and everything. And, but she, I could just feel her, you know, looking right through me almost as, you know, just judging me and making sure that, you know, I was what I said I was.
Because you were going to take care of her family is really what it was.
I was
going to
take care of her family. Exactly. Yeah. But I was... You know, I looked at it as, especially in this situation, which was unique to me, I looked like I was taking care of her because I felt like you're coming into my funeral home and I'm coming to get you and I want you to know that I'm going to take care of you and I'm going to use the utmost care like I would if it was my mother. You know, that's kind of – and I think I used those words to her. And so, you know, I fully expected them to – go. Sometimes people price shop. They go down the street.
Sure.
Or go there. It's no different than, you know, that situation. And, you know, she stopped me and she just locked eyes with me and paused and, you know, kept nodding at me. And I never left her eyes. I was just looking her straight in the eye. And she said, no, I want you to take care of me. And, you know, I was blown away trying to have that professional veneer that I thought I could do. But even at this time, I was just like, oh, man, I'm so locked into her story. And, you know, she had children. She had a son and a daughter. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, I start thinking about my two sons that I had, I think, at the time. And, you know, you're empathizing, but you're also, you know, to be good at what you do, I think you put yourself in that person's shoes, right? And so we went through it. Yeah, we went through the entire funeral arrangement, and I got the call a couple months later. Didn't recognize the name, and they said they specifically requested you, Chris. And so I went there and, you know, pull in to the driveway and see her husband at the door. And, you know, I'm like biting my inside of my cheek because I'm like, I know why I'm here. And he came out and gave me a hug, and, you know, the kids are there, and I was fighting it. I was just biting my mouth and smiling and say, okay, I got mom, you know, and I turned in the corner and she's in the middle of the room. And I describe in the book, I think, you know, it was one of the most beautiful scenes that I had seen in my lifetime because, you know, it just said to me, family, and it just said, you know, comfort. And it was in the middle of the living room. It was a cot that obviously hospice or the hospital had brought in. And she was surrounded by just, you know, pictures of her children and stuffed animals and, you know, warm afghans that you could see were sort of heirlooms from the family that maybe grandma had knitted. And it just, there was just like comfort and serenity and quiet. And, you know, I I knelt down and I took her back to the funeral home, and it was just one of the most impactful moments because I had just been with her 3 months before, and there was sort of I don't want to say relationship,
but there was a connection. Which you don't have with all the rest.
I think you don't have with all the rest.
So what?
Well, and I feel like it's different just because it was 5 years at the point, right? So you dealt with a lot of dead bodies, but not with a lot of live people.
Right.
I remember. Yeah. So one of my first experiences with death was on a story where someone had a bad accident over a cliff, and I remember seeing her alive in the stretcher, and she left. And then 3 days later, reading about how she died. And that was the first experience of like, this person was here and is not now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Huge, hugely different. And I think you alluded to it. It's just when someone comes in dead, but when you have, even if it was that fleeting hour and a half that we spent together, I felt that I was identified with her. And, you know, more so for the children. It's like, how do these children go now?
My father passed away 4 years ago, and it was just, it was miserable. Mm. And I was ultra private about it. Nobody really at work knew about it. It just really, didn't want to live it on social media. But I remember going through, when the end came, it was very unexpected. And I remember making the arrangements with my brother and sister. And I was back in Texas for a good solid week, and we basically drank through my father's wine cellar while we made those arrangements. And the phone calls that you make, and you know the conversations you have. I mean, like they get funny, maybe with the wine, but they do at times kind of get funny. You know, like I remember looking at my brother, and it was like 1 a.m. I said, "You know, we need a bagpiper at this thing." And he goes, "Yeah." And so I like Google bagpiper funeral Dallas Fort Worth. I found a guy who had played for Bono.
More absurd. Yeah,
I hired him over a text message, and let me tell you, he killed it.
Yeah,
it was great. And you know,
he crushed it.
Yeah,
I love it.
Oh, but you know, what's funny is like you know, we had these moments as a family because there are very few universal things in life. One of them is being born. We've all done it, and the other one is death.
Yes.
And so the thing is that I really learned going through an ultra personal experience with a close family member dying. Is that other people reach out to you in a way, and you see things in people that you never saw before because they get it. And that, to me, is kind of the real theme of your book, is that this is not necessarily a scary thing. It's actually, we learn a lot about life through death.
Absolutely. And I think, I talk about that in the book specifically about your experience with death is, I feel, a lot of times commensurate with the amount of how much you love that person or how close you were to that person, right? So if it's your dad, right, it's probably this massively heightened experience, whereas if it's, you know, your neighbor, second cousin, twice removed, it's a little maybe less impactful, right? But that universality is something that I wanted to tap into, and I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't writing a funeral book. I want it to be more.
It's really not.
Yeah, I think it's more of a reminder of like, hey man, let's all go for it, you know? Let's go for it. This is, you get one shot, right? If we're lucky, it's what, 85, you know, 90 years, God willing, you know? That would be it, but let's just go for it. Just go all in. And that's what I tell my kids, right? I'm like, hey man, Dad might not be the richest guy in the face of the earth, but I'm going to be in your life, and I'm going to be at every school event, and I'm all in. And when I coach, I'm going to go crazy. I am that guy.
You know, you're that guy.
Deirdre, you and I talked about your husband coaching. But
he turned into
you
that
can
guy.
Come in. You will see me. I am that guy. But I tell those boys that. I said, I'm here, and I am all in. Just give me what I'm giving you, and we're all good. So yeah, no, it's. I think it's a life book. You know, I think it's a how to find our happiness. How to find. I don't want to say self-help. I'm just, you know, so go for it. And it sounds like that's what your podcast is all about too. So that's kind of really cool. Like,
I think it could be a screenplay.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that. So I've always envisioned it as a Broadway play, like a one-man show.
I know
Someone tells the stories, not necessarily only from the book, but from their own life. And, you know, I think there is such a commonality in death, and you hit it. We all are born and we all die. But telling those stories kind of eases it a little bit, and you can find some truth in it with your own experience or maybe what you're going to experience. And I think there is that commonality. But knowing that we're all only here for a finite time, why wouldn't we just go for it when we're here.
Have you planned your funeral?
I have not. So that is a great question because now I'm embarrassed. Yes. So
I know
I am in the funeral business, or I was more in the funeral business years ago. Now I'm segueing out. But yes, I'm all about memorializing. But for me, I want the simplest thing with nothing too involved. So that's just what I'm thinking.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Real quickly, because I know we got to wrap up. Mm-hmm. I was alluding, I think this would be a great screenplay. I can totally see a movie. The one person who I guarantee will not be in your movie is Mel Gibson.
Yes. No, Mel is not going to be in my movie.
Why will Mel not be in your movie?
Okay. So as I mentioned, being an aspiring screenwriter in Hollywood, you do a multitude of jobs. And one of my jobs was during the Oscar season was to send out movies to every member of AMPAS, which is the Motion Picture Association, whatever the acronym is, to all those people who vote on movies. And I worked at a small studio called Paramount Classics. And the head of the studio had seen my movie, and she thought very well of me. And she recommended me for the first assistant to Mel Gibson. So he was.
How many are there?
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. But I thought first assistant sounded way better than third. So I was like, yes, I'm interested in
doing
that.
They weren't going to promote second or third? Like, is this a hire from within organization?
So he had one of these vanity production companies on the lot. And I got an appointment to go read with him or talk to him about the interview for his job. And so they were working on this movie called Once We Were Warriors, but written by Randall Wallace, who wrote Braveheart. And so I got a hold of this script. It was a Vietnam script. I called it Vietnam Braveheart because it seems like, you know, he did The Patriot. I thought it was American Revolution Braveheart. They were all kind of similar to me. So I read the script. I analyzed it. I knew it from every single angle. I mean, that's what I was doing in Hollywood. I was analyzing scripts for a production company. So I ripped this thing apart and I was just massaged it. And I was like, what if he did this and that? And so I went in there to this beautiful, beautiful garden-like serene setting on this Gower lot. And I sat down and out walks Mel Gibson in like blue jeans and a flannel. And I think they were Birkenstocks, right? And so I'm a big guy. So I got up and shook his hand. And he was a little bit small, but he was like that shifty-eyed, lethal weapon kind of guy, right? I was like, wait, is this a movie or what? So we sat down, just he and I, and we just sat there and talked. And he would ask me a couple of questions. And then he said, hey, I don't know if you've read my new script, but I'm going to make this movie. And this is why I'm going to. I was like, oh, yeah, I totally read it. I got it. And he said, well, tell me about it. What do you think of it? And then I started to rip it apart. I absolutely, in my mind, I was telling him how to make the script better, the script that, you know, the Academy Award winning Randall Wallace had written.
Yeah. Right? How'd that go for you?
Yeah, it didn't go so well. So I started to tell him, and as God is my witness, Mel just sat there and he looked at everything I was saying and he just nodded his head. And I went on for probably 15 minutes. And I just ripped it to shreds. And after he was done, he was like, you know, I guess you didn't like it that much. And I said, well, I thought it had problems. You know, I think it needs a love interest. And he looked at me for like a long second, and his eyes were so beautiful and blue. I couldn't believe it. I was looking at him, I'm like, man, they're just beautiful. And he looked at me and he said, hey, have you ever gotten in a fight? And I was like, what the heck did he mean by that? And I'm like, looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I'm like, is he gonna like come over here and just like fire a punch into my juice box? And so I said, well, yeah, I was in law. I was at school one time and I had too much to drink and I got, you know, beaten up by a group of kids when I was wising off to them on the way home. And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, I could see that. And that was it. He picked up and walked out.
Oh, man.
And I went back to the head of the studio and she's like, well, how'd it go? And I go, it didn't go so well. And she goes, yeah, I heard. Yeah, I heard. And so I talk about that in a chapter called Failure in my book. And you know, we need to fail in life, right? Because we need to love. I mean, we need to hurt to love, right? We need to fail to succeed. All these things are stepping stones for something greater. And I hearken back to that Mel Gibson story with everyone who will listen and say, hey, man, whatever you're failing at is not as bad. Didn't get the job, needless to say.
And so, this is why I love the book. Yeah. Tell people where to find the book and how to follow you on social media.
So I'm everywhere on social media. You can find the book on Amazon. The audiobook will be out in about a week.
And the official title of the book. Let's make sure we give that out so they can find it.
So I think it's Life in 20 Lessons, What a Funeral Guy Found Out About Life from Death. And it's on Amazon, and you can find me at chrismeyerauthor.com. That's really important because you can order the book there.
I love that you just gave me a look like, what's the name of my book again?
That's so huge
in promotion. I left you out to dangle because I've got it right here.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you, Deirdre.
Yeah. Again, Savannah Guthrie would not have done this. Actually, I know Savannah. She might have done it a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
Best of luck with it. It's a really fun read.
Oh, I appreciate
and there's
it.
A lot of really great life advice in there as well. And I could talk all day. You've got some really great stories.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Was that what you expected?
No. I feel like we could summarize this one as hashtag YOLO.
Yes. You really could. You know, and I don't know what this guy's going to do next. It's clearly something else because, you know, it's 10 years. He's probably due for, you know, a change again. But he's really onto something. I could listen to him tell stories forever. They were great.
Yeah.
All right. So go check out the book. I think you're going to really like it. In the meantime, if you liked this episode, let us know about it. Screenshot the episode. And if you could share it on social, that would be awesome. And make sure you tag us. You can tag the show on Instagram at Dying to Ask Podcast. And then you can tag me at Run Read Sip.
I am at Producer Jeff.
Indeed you are. Very much in the land of the living right now.
For now.
Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends, and we'll see you again next time.
Bye.